Alrighty, here we go. We're working on how to discern the will of God and to just determine. We're presented with different ideas from time to time. People offer us things that they think we ought to do or know from the Bible, and we want to make sure that we do this right. Now, we're going to listen to five shorter portions of this presentation from the Richland Hills Church of Christ, and the presentations are available in their entirety on the website. You're welcome to get those from the website, or you can get them from us. They've been very courageous to put those out and make them available for public listening. And we've got them, and we'd be happy to share them so that you're confident that you're hearing the entire presentation and not just selected portions that I think you ought to listen to. Now, last week we were talking about these five portions, but we didn't finish those five, and we want to finish the last two. And just to remind you, we're talking about Old Testament reasons for accepting instrumental music in Christian worship. And I pointed out that there really aren't any Old Testament reasons for accepting instrumental music in Christian worship. That's a fallacy to begin with. But nevertheless, we're going to listen to everything that he has to say. So let's go ahead and charge into this.
Instrumental music. We saw already the singers and the players with one voice lifting praise to God at the dedication of the temple. Look at the rest of that passage in Chronicles chapter 5. Then the temple of the Lord was filled with a cloud, and the priest could not perform the service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the temple of God. God was pleased with the praise that they was offered that day. Let me make another strong statement. There is no hint in the entire Bible that God was ever anything but pleased by instrumental praise offered from sincere hearts. Now, you do have texts like Amos 6 where the prophet says you sit on your fine couches and you cover yourself with loyals and you eat your fattened calf and you pluck your instruments like David. And he's condemning their self-indulgence and the fact that they aren't burdened over the sin of Judah. And that's why they went into exile. You do find places in the Old Testament where God condemns fasting, he condemns Sabbath, he condemns any ritual or any act of worship that's done unsincerely. But there is not a hint anywhere in the Bible that God was ever anything but pleased by instrumental praise offered from a sincere heart. By the way, remember that God declared a musician to be a man after his own heart.
Obviously, he's talking about David there. When he says, by the way, remember that God declared a musician to be a man after his own heart, this is what we call a red herring argument. It has absolutely nothing to do with the issue. We certainly would never, and I don't think he would make the claim that God was pleased with David because he was a musician. That's not germane to the point at all. It was interesting. He said, and I didn't cue on this before, and I told you before we can't talk about every statement that Mr. Atchley makes. He said something to the effect that God was never anything but pleased anywhere in the Bible by instrumental praise. Well, yeah, that would be all Old Testament usage, though, wouldn't it? Because there isn't any noted in the New Testament. So that's, he's absolutely safe talking about that. Was God pleased with David because he was a musician? Well, no. That was incidental to his life and his obedience to God. All right, let's get this last section here and just listen to the last of the five things that Mr. Atchley had to say in this section.
Point from the Old Testament. Messianic prophecy anticipated. Instrumental music would continue in the coming kingdom. Look with me at Psalm 45, 6 and 7. Your throne, O God, will last forever and ever. A scepter of justice will be the scepter of your kingdom. You'll love righteousness and you hate wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has set you above your companions by anointing you with the oil of joy. Now, that psalm is probably a wedding song celebrating the marriage of a king of Israel to his bride. And yet, the Spirit guides the Hebrew author in chapter 1 to take that passage and refer it to Christ, because he quotes that exact passage in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 8 and 9. Look at the next verse from that psalm. All your robes are fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. From palaces adorned with ivory, the music of the strings makes you glad. And so the Spirit takes this metaphor of this king about to be married and applies it to the coming Messiah. Certainly the people who knew that psalm well could not possibly imagine that the Messiah was not glad by the praise of instruments as the king was. But even more convicting, I think, is Romans chapter 15. For I tell you that Christ has become a servant of the Gentiles on behalf of God's truth, to confirm the promises made to the patriarchs, so that the Gentiles may glorify God for His mercy, as it is written, therefore I will praise you among the Gentiles. I will sing hymns to your name. Now, the problem there is there are several places in the Psalms where you have a verse like that. Most likely, David is quoting Psalm 18:49 or Psalm 57, verse 9. And in both of those Psalms, the Hebrew word there for sing hymns to your name is the Hebrew word zamar. You won't find a lexicon anywhere that fails to include instruments in defining what the word zamar meant. So Paul says, here's the prophecy, that in the Messianic age, the Gentiles are going to zamar to your name. Just to be sure what that word means, look at Psalm 57 where Paul is quoting that verse, 7 through 9. My heart is steadfast, O God, my heart is steadfast. I will sing and make music. Awake, my soul, awake, harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations. I will sing of you among the peoples. And so what have we learned? In the Old Testament, God commands instrumental praise. God blesses instrumental praise. And God prophesies its use in the Messianic age. Now, if God's attitude toward instrumental music changed in the New Testament, you would expect one of the following three things: a clear passage condemning its use, a clear passage commanding a cappella praise only, or a prophecy announcing the end of instrumental music. Is that what we find in the New Testament? Let's turn now to the New Testament and talk about reasons for accepting instrumental praise.
And we're going to do that just in a minute. We actually are going to turn to the New Testament. I want to talk to you a little bit about what he says here. This is a tricky kind of thing, because what he's done is he's approached the Old Testament and worked very hard within the Psalms. What he's doing is called guilt by association. We're using one part of the psalm, therefore the rest of the psalm applies also. Well, that's not necessarily true. See, we got a little problem about that. This is actually the first thing that he said, which I cut off the first couple of words off as I was editing the audio clip. Then one last point from the Old Testament: messianic prophecy anticipated instrumental music would continue in the coming kingdom. This is a false assertion. It absolutely does not say anything like that. And it's based on an improper use of these Old Testament passages that he's heaping up here. And it gives the impression that there's a lot of biblical evidence for this. But in fact, there's no biblical evidence whatsoever. Let me show you what I'm talking about. He says, yet the Spirit guides a Hebrew author in chapter 1 to take that passage. And by the way, it's Psalm 18. Psalm 57 verse 9 doesn't quite work out in the original language. It's Psalm 18 that is being quoted here. He quotes that exact passage in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 8 and 9. Look at the next verse from that psalm. All your robes are fragrant with myrrhs and aloes and cassia, from palaces adorned with ivory. The music of the strings makes you glad. And so the Spirit takes this metaphor of this king about to be married and applies it to the coming Messiah. Certainly the people who knew that psalm well could not possibly imagine the Messiah was not glad by the praise of instruments as the king was. The truth of the matter is, and we've seen this in many cases in the Bible, inspired writers can apply verses in a way that we can't. They can do that by inspiration. Matthew does that in the Gospel of Matthew. Talks about a passage out of Hosea that clearly applies to the nation of Israel, and he applies it to Jesus. Out of Egypt I called my son. He can do that by inspiration of the Holy Spirit. We don't have that ability to do that. So the Hebrew writer, as the other inspired writers, have used the portions of Scripture that they wanted to use to make the point that they're trying to make. And he's not making a point about the use of instruments. This doesn't have anything to do with the use of instruments. He's talking about the superiority of the Son. The Hebrew writers use the Psalm 45. I'm sorry, that's over in Romans 15 that Psalm 18 is used. But the writer's use of Psalm 45, verses 6 and 7 does not include verse 8. It's not important to his point. That's not the direction that he was going. So he's able to use verse 6 and 7 and use it entirely accurately. He's inspired. He has that ability. We don't. Then he goes on to say, even more convicting, I think, is Romans chapter 15. For I tell you that Christ has become a servant of the Gentiles on behalf of God's truth to confirm the promises made to the patriarch, so that the Gentiles may glorify God for his mercy. As it is written, therefore I will praise you among the Gentiles, I will sing hymns to your name. Now the problem there are several places in the Psalms where you have a verse like that. Most likely David is quoting Psalm 18:49. That's where the quote comes from. In both of these psalms, the Hebrew word there for sing hymns to your name is the Hebrew word zamar. You won't find a lexicon anywhere that fails to include instruments in defining what the word zamar meant. So Paul says, here's the prophecy, that in the Messianic age, the Gentiles are going to zamar to your name. Okay. Here's a fact. We want to be on the lookout for facts here and not just assertions. Zamar, the Hebrew word zamar, does in fact include the instrument. And any lexicon, he's quite right about that. You can go to any lexicon and look it up and it'll tell you that zamar includes the idea of using an instrument. But the reality is Paul didn't quote Hebrew. He's writing to Romans, Gentile Christians. And he used the Greek translation, the Septuagint version, and in that version, the word that's used is a word for sing, and it does not comprehend the use of instruments. It doesn't mean it necessarily includes instruments. Paul wrote in Greek, not in Hebrew. The Roman Christians to whom Paul is writing would certainly not have understood that this would include instruments of music. It's just not real. It's just not possible. Let me say one other thing about that. Anytime you get into linguistic arguments, very highly technical arguments about the dictionary meaning of this word and that word and something like that, you are on very shaky ground. The original languages have some wonderful insights to bring to us from time to time, but the reality is you can trust your translations, folks. These guys are good. And the work of translators is a highly difficult and technical discipline. And there's a lot more that goes into it than just dictionary definitions of words. We know that from our common speech day to day. Okay, we've got some interesting insights that can come from the original language, but wow, when you get into technical vocabulary problems, it's very difficult. And then you probably feel automatically at a disadvantage. How many of you are good at Hebrew? You good at Hebrew? I am barely competent in Hebrew. Barely. All right. How good are you at Greek? We probably got a lot better shot at Greek. How are you doing on your Greek? See, already you feel kind of out of your league. Here you got an expert telling you what these things mean, and you really don't feel competent to challenge this expert. Well, that's a problem too. Alright, his assertion that God prophesies its use in the Messianic age is without any biblical foundation. He didn't quote a prophecy. He didn't quote anything out of the Old Testament that said that instrumental music would continue in the New Testament. He didn't say anything like that. What he did was a guilt by association plea by reaching back here and dragging other verses out of the Psalm and saying, well, it includes that too. Well, how do you know it includes that? The inspired writers didn't think it included that. So his whole appeal to Old Testament usage is based on distortions of the Bible, false reasoning, and irrelevant arguments. And if you just listened to this thing all in one sitting, you'd be impressed because you've gotten a lot of Bible passages and you've gotten some expert testimony about linguistic arguments and things like that. It just doesn't hold. Anybody have any comments, questions, anything you'd like to say about these last two segments? Yes, sir. Are we going to send him a correction? no, we're not. He's had a lot of corrections sent to him, and he is not interested in tackling these corrections. Remember, one of the things that we talked about early on, he pointed out that he had been convicted of this more than 10 years ago. I think 13 years ago or 14 years ago, he had been convicted that instrumental music was right and proper in New Testament worship. And then he spent 10 years apparently laying some groundwork and studying with elders and so on to come to the point of introduction. So I'm quite sure that he believes that he has read and heard everything that could be said on the subject, and he is able to refute any correction we might like to offer. Yes, sir.
I wonder
Tommy, you're asking, you know, what motivates him? You're asking a question that we ask frequently. Why is he doing this? Why is he doing this? I have no interest in questioning his motives. I'm going to listen to what he has to say. He says he's convicted that this is the right thing to do. I'm just going to have to let it stand at that. You'd be interested to know if he plays an instrument seriously. He might. I don't know. I don't know. I do, but I don't think it has any point in Christian worship, so I'm not going to be dragging my Stratocaster in here to irritate you. Go ahead. Well, you're asking about New Testament usage, and that's the very next thing we're going to tackle, because that's exactly where he goes. And that's... I could pay you for that nice little segue into this next... segment. Paul's instruction to Timothy to stay away from questions that generate strife, controversies, arguments. I'm sure he's seen it all, but see, Bill, what he's thinking, apparently, and you can correct me if I misread him here, he believes that our insistence on a cappella worship is the actual source of the division. That if we could eliminate this source of division by adopting instruments. So he would say that we are the ones who have been strife-filled, contentious, argumentative, and so on. So again, you know, it's curious. Yes, sir. Has he convinced any other churches? I do not know. I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see. I know certainly that there are people who are very interested in following this same practice. Now, whether they're going to use his argumentation to do it, my belief is that others who want to bring in instruments will use his words and his arguments to do this. And one of the reasons we're doing this whole class is to realize how people use fictitious arguments and bad, bad Bible study to bring in unbiblical positions. The whole idea is critical thinking. We're just using this as a case study. I think I'm going to say that again as we start the next one. I'm sorry? He's good at what he's doing. I said that from the very beginning. He's a very persuasive speaker. He's easy to listen to. He's obviously energized, kind of excited about this. So, well, let's charge ahead here into the next session. This is actually this week's lesson. That was the end of last week. This is part five, and the idea is we're trying to figure out how to deal with these ideas that are offered for our adoption. We just want to think clearly about this. We want to determine the will of God. We're just using these lessons as an example of the kinds of presentations that we might hear, because I want you not only to walk out after this class is over, I want you not only to walk out thinking, well, the case for using instruments of music in Christian worship is plainly not made here, but I want you also to be very aware of how to deal with any presentation that someone brings you to determine whether it's biblical or not. So, we're just using this as a case study. Basic guidelines, we've talked about this before. This is a handout that I gave. Number one, be willing to study, but require convincing. Don't just adopt a position because somebody you like or someone who sounds persuasive has given it to you. Listen for hard data and facts. We'd like to hear some statistical breakdowns. You know, he makes some assertions about the size of the church and our and our growth or decline. I'd like to hear some hard data and facts. We need to be sure that the Bible texts are presented properly, that they're understood properly, that they actually apply to the situation we're talking about. We want to consider the historical heritage of the topic. How has the church understood this for 2,000 years? If this is a brand new interpretation and never been heard before, why is it that so many people were wrong for so long about this? We need to discover the attitudes that we personally have that lead me to want to accept or to want to reject the idea. I don't want to be caught up in my... I know I have my own biases, but I don't want to be caught up in false and fictitious pleading trying to avoid Bible passages just because I want to believe one way or the other. So I want to, you know, think about my own attitudes here. We certainly need to pray for wisdom and discernment in all of this. God will give wisdom to those who ask for it. And then when we're convinced that we know God's will, embrace it and obey it wholeheartedly. We don't need to be sitting on the fence in any of this stuff. We need to... I want to start with the reminder of the very last thing that he said. And I intentionally included that last paragraph on the last session, and it's also the first thing that we're going to hear today. Now, if God's attitude toward instrumental music changed in the New Testament, you would expect one of the following three things. A clear passage condemning its use. It seems reasonable, doesn't it? A clear passage commanding a cappella praise only. That too seems reasonable. Or a prophecy announcing the end of instrumental music. Is that what we find in the New Testament? Well, let's turn now to the New Testament and talk about reasons for accepting instrumental praise. Actually, this is a false dilemma argument. I hope you didn't buy that. See, these three things are not the only things we might expect. He's given you three possibilities and assumed that that's all the possibilities that there are in the entire world. That's a false dilemma. They're not the only three things. We might expect a theological principle that actually extends to worship music. Mightn't we? Could we expect that? We might expect a consistent example of the early church. Might we expect something like that? We might expect an individual incident that teaches us something about worship practice. Hey, we might expect a lot of things. What we get is the New Testament. Doesn't matter what we might expect. What we have to work with is the text of the New Testament, and that's all we have to work with. If the New Testament is our rule of faith and practice, we'll find guidance for our worship in it. And that's, you know, we might expect a lot of things. I was visiting with a young man not very long ago, very intelligent, very well-educated, professional young man, talking about some facts out of the Bible, and he wanted some proof. The Christian evidence is kind of stuff, you know, and proof, you want proof, more and more. And I said, look, we might wish we had a lot more evidence, but this is what we've got. This is what we have to work with. Okay, let's consider the reasons offered from the New Testament for the adoption of instruments in Christian worship. And again, I've split this up into five little sections so that we can hear what he has to say and consider what he has to say. And let's just go ahead and charge into this.
Now, if God's attitude toward instrumental music changed in the New Testament,
here's your false dilemma.
You would expect one of the following three things. A clear passage condemning its use.
That'd be nice.
A clear passage commanding a cappella praise only.
That would be nice.
Or a prophecy announcing the end of instrumental music.
They'd clear it up.
Is that what we find in the New Testament? Let's turn now to the New Testament and talk about reasons for accepting instrumental praise. Number one, Jesus never deals with the issue. The anti-instrument advocates must speak where Jesus has not spoken. He did speak much about the role of sincere heart in worship, but he never addressed the issue of music once. And you would think he would if this was worth splitting his church over.
So he thinks
now, it is interesting. In the great parable of the prodigal son, you'll recall at the end, the elder brother's in the field and he's angry and he says, they were making music. The word there is symphonos. It's where we get our word symphony. It's only used in the Old Testament Septuagint. It's in Daniel where you have that story about whenever all the instruments are blown, you're supposed to bow down and worship the king. The word meant band. And so in this powerful metaphor of a prodigal who's come back to the people of God, who's back in the house of God, Jesus says they were having a party and there was a band. You'd have a hard time, based on what Jesus said, arguing he had a problem with instrumental praise. We know that Jesus taught regularly in the temple in the presence of instrumental praise. And you'll note he did not cast out the musicians with the money changers.
All right. He says that the anti-instrument advocates must speak where Jesus has not spoken. He did speak much about the role of sincere heart in worship, never addressed the issue of music once. And you'd think he would if this was worth splitting the church over. Okay, this is an argument from silence, which everyone admits is pretty weak. And he later, in this same presentation, he decries an argument from silence as something very contrived. He really doesn't like that. But it suits his purpose here, and so he goes ahead and brings it in. Why doesn't this prove anything here? What's wrong with this? What's wrong with saying that Jesus never condemned instrumental music? What's wrong with that? The church did not arrive until His death, burial, and resurrection from the dead. We're still in the Old Testament, aren't we? Are we under an old covenant until Christ is raised from the dead? Well, of course. So this, again, this has absolutely nothing to say. Here's this long discussion here about the word symphonos. They were making music. So he's talking about the prodigal son, the story of the lost son. And he comes home. They're having a party, a nice big band there. And you'd have a hard time, based on what Jesus said, arguing he'd have a problem with instrumental praise. We know that Jesus taught regularly in the temple in the presence of instrumental praise, and you'll note he did not cast out the musicians with the money changers. Ha ha ha. Okay. Two observations for you here. Number one, he persistently confuses private activity, a party at the house, with public corporate worship. We're not talking about the same thing at all, are we? We're not talking about the same thing at all. We're having a party in the parable. It's just, you know, it's for us. It doesn't have anything to do with worshiping God. And so he makes that confusion. And then the second thing is what you've already clued on. Jesus' worship in the temple was perfectly in keeping with the Old Testament provisions. He's there. This is the covenant that was in operation at the time. He's obedient to that covenant. This whole thing is just irrelevant and just designed to confuse the issue. Jesus didn't have any problem with instruments of music. Well, that's true. Neither did anyone else in the Old Covenant. But that really doesn't prove anything here. Any comments, questions, anything you'd like to point out about it? Yes, sir. No. Oh, Jesus never said anything about gambling. Well, that's true. Can we figure that out on our own, you reckon? I think we can kind of figure that one out. He said enough about many things to help us learn to live properly. It's okay. Prodigal son had some dancing going on at the house, too. What's his position on that? We don't want to know. He hadn't brought that up. Yes, sir. Were there animal sacrifices going on in the temple too? Well, you know, I kind of think there were. And we're going to have to talk about that because that becomes an important part of the temple worship. In fact, I think we're going to jump right into it right now. I'll pay you later for that segue. Thank you. Let's go on.
Second point. Instrumental music is a non-issue in the book of Acts. Now again, we do know that the early disciples met daily in the temple courts. Apparently, they could worship in spirit and truth in the presence of instrumental music. But nowhere in Acts is a pattern for musical praise specified. In fact, nowhere in the New Testament is congregational singing specifically authorized. Now, you heard me. Let me say that again. Nowhere in the New Testament is congregational singing specifically authorized. And you're thinking, well, now I know there are verses in the New Testament telling us to sing. Let's look at those.
He's going to charge into that in a minute because that's actually point number three. I want to stop right here for just a second where he says, instrumental music is a non-issue in the book of Acts. Again, we do know that the early disciples met daily in the temple courts, and that is quite right. Apparently, they could worship in spirit and truth in the presence of instrumental music. Well, let's talk about that just for a second, because you need to get a picture of the temple in your mind. It is true that the disciples met in the temple courts at first, and we have these passages in Acts that specifically point out that they were in the temple courts and specifically in Solomon's portico or Solomon's colonnade. But the temple complex covered an area of about 35 acres. In size. That's a lot of territory, folks. Solomon's colonnade stretched over a quarter of a mile along the eastern wall of the city there. And at its closest, at its very closest point, it would be about 200 yards from this altar to Solomon's portico. And we presume that the instruments would be used around the altar. One of the reasons instruments were used in the old world, or in the ancient world, was to mask the sounds of the slaughter of the animals that was going on. You know, most animals will not just stand around and say, oh, is it my turn? You know, they have several things to say about this process. The instruments would have been played at the morning and evening sacrifices. This is not something that's going to go on all day long. The instruments truly were a non-issue because they were way too far away to impact the early church worship. Think of it this way. What if they have a band playing over here at the airport this morning? Are we going to know anything about it? We're too far away. And that's not as far away as it would be from the one end of Solomon's portico to the other. We're talking a quarter of a mile, actually over a quarter of a mile. So it's just a false statement to say that they were worshiping in the presence of instruments. Were they? How, you know, what constitutes the presence? Certainly they could be heard in their prayers over any sound of instruments or any of the other hubbub going around there. I think it's really important for us to kind of get this picture in our minds and think accurately about what's being claimed. He's claiming that they worship in the presence of instruments. I'm not buying it at all. Comments, questions, anything that you'd like to bring up about this? I'm sorry? I believe it does. Well, let's take a look at a couple of these passages here. Let's go to Acts chapter 5 real quickly. It says they met together, certainly. And if I'm wrong, I'll be glad to know that. Verse 12, all the believers used to meet together in Solomon's colonnade. Verse 25, someone came and said, look, the men you put in jail are standing in the temple courts teaching the people. There's teaching going on. Verse 42, day after day in the temple courts and from house to house, they never stopped teaching and proclaiming the good news that Jesus is the Christ. Well, you know, it doesn't really sound like a worship service that's going on there, does it? Let's back up to chapter 3. Peter and John going up to the temple at the time of prayer at 3 in the afternoon. Verse 11, while the beggar held on to Peter and John, all the people were astonished and came running to them in the place called Solomon's colonnade. Well, that doesn't really sound like a worship either, does it? Back up to chapter 2, verse 46, every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes, ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. It sounds like worship is happening, but it doesn't specifically say that worship is happening. I'm willing to concede his point. I'm willing to concede that they were worshiping in the temple courts, but I don't think that you can make the jump from there to say also that they were in the presence of instruments. I don't think that will fly at all. But I appreciate the fact that you're reading those passages really carefully and looking to hear, does it say, what does it say there? Yes, sir, Leon. Yes. And he has flatly said so earlier. We're going to have to come back to that too. Is it a great distraction? Well, you know, you've got a point, and you're not the first one to say that, but we'll tackle that too. Because you got to get in the mood. Well, part of the point of the music is to get you in the mood. Yeah, got the rhythm. They're dancing in the aisles. Things are good. Well, okay, you know. You had a comment? I didn't mean to just pass over you. Can't see where the instrument has anything to do with salvation. Mm-hmm. Okay. If it's not an issue, if Jesus doesn't make an issue out of it, why are we making an issue out of it? What it has to do with is submission. What it has to do with is, will we follow God or will we do what we like? I'm sorry, I missed that. Can you say it again? Mm-hmm. Okay, your point is, if Jesus didn't talk about it, then how do we know one way or the other whether this is right or wrong? Well, we actually do have plenty of scriptures to talk about that, whether it is right or wrong. And part of the problem that we're running into is this man is actually distorting the scriptures and using them wrongly to try to advocate a point that is clearly wrong. You know, we've seen this so many times, and he'll eventually go beyond the scriptural argument, which he cannot possibly sustain, because there is no argument from scripture for introducing instruments of music in Christian worship, and there is a strong argument for, you know, keeping them out of Christian worship. Then he goes into the church history, and that's where my blood really starts to boil. I mean, it's bad enough when he's handling the scriptures badly, but when he goes into church history and tries to say some things that didn't happen at all, you come back and watch my head pop right off. There's going to be so much fun. They'll be cleaning me up for a week in here. Yes, ma'am. At the beginning, did he say they were going to do this? Yes, he did. It's going to be on a Saturday, yes. And not... I'm sorry? Well, he's going to justify Saturday later on. I mean, he says several things that are troublesome to us. Talks about taking the Lord's Supper on Saturday and things like that. But see, the use of instruments is not the only part of this presentation that is very troubling to us. And so we want to hear the whole thing, listen to what he has to say. We're going to listen to all 3 hours that he presented there, and we'll listen to what he has to say. But I think in listening to it, we'll also come away able to deal with passages and presentations like this in a way that we really do submit to God. And, I mean, we want to know his will, and we want to do his will. Okay. We're out of time, really. They just haven't blown the whistle on me. Yes, sir. I'm sorry? He's saying that the Old Testament temple is a pattern for the church. I hesitate to try to say anything beyond what he says in the presentations, because we really can only deal with what he says. There they go. I'm pretty confident, honestly, I'm pretty confident that he would say that the provisions of the Old Covenant are, in fact, done away with. So animal sacrifices, incense, things like that are not a part of Christian worship. However, what you, I think, accurately have seen is that the same argumentation that will introduce this element of Old Testament worship into New Testament worship will, in fact, introduce other elements of Old Testament worship into New Testament worship as well. So... He actually does talk about the synagogue. And again, you know, all these presentations are available. You can get them, take them, listen to them, and come loaded for bear. You can come primed to ask all the hard questions. And I'm sorry that we really are out of time this morning, but we're gonna start here with his third point next week. There is no real hope that we're ever going to get completely back on schedule.